Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. As usual, taking your phone calls if you have questions that you'd like to raise for conversation about the Bible or the Christian faith or anything related to your own spiritual journey, or if you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, either as a Christian who sees things differently or as a non-Christian who sees everything differently, feel free to give me a call and we will be glad to have a conversation about that together. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. And right now our lines are open, so you could get right through if you call now. I received an email from Carol in Coolidge, Arizona. She said, Steve, our Sunday school material said that the people in the Old Testament did not believe in life after death. And she talks about, we were in Ecclesiastes, give some verse numbers there. And she says, I brought up that David in Psalm 23 says that he would live in the house of the Lord forever. So at least he must have believed in life after death. The material was not referring to soul sleep, but that they thought death was the end. I would appreciate your take on this. Blessings, Carol. And by the way, before I answer her question, she also says, P.S., I would sure like to know if anyone else in my area listens to you. I have a flyer in the post office. I don't think she's a criminal, but I think she means trying to find people. And put my contact information at the bottom, but I've received no calls. So if you live in the Coolidge, Arizona area and you want to contact Carol, yeah, just go to the post office and look on the bulletin board there and you can find out how to reach her. She'd like to meet other listeners in her area. But the question she has is, they were discussing in Sunday school whether or not people in the Old Testament believed in a life after death. And she says they were not discussing soul sleep. Now, if you know what soul sleep is, now that's the view that people, when they die, they're not alive, but they will come alive again in the resurrection. So death is not really the end. It is a temporary end, but then life is renewed when Jesus returns and the dead are raised. That's not the view that they were suggesting. They're suggesting that the Old Testament people didn't even believe in a resurrection of the dead. They just believed that when you died, that's all there was. There's never anything more. Now, I will say that resurrection is a doctrine that comes from the Old Testament. And Jesus even found evidence for it way back in Exodus chapter 3 when he was arguing with the Sadducees about it. And when he said that Moses met God at the burning bush and God said to him, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, of course, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have been long dead, hundreds of years dead, at the time that Moses came to the burning bush and God made these statements. So when God said, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he's saying, I'm the God of these three men who have a long time ago died. Now, Jesus makes the point from this, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And therefore, if these men are dead, or at least if they're going to stay dead, then God can hardly be their God anymore. And yet he said he was, even after they died. And the point Jesus is making is there's an implication here about the resurrection from the dead. But I don't know how many people would have seen it that way. I mean, I accept what Jesus said as correct, but I don't know that very many rabbis would have read that into it. I don't know that many Jews hearing that verse would have thought it through like that. And therefore, even though Jesus said there are hints about the resurrection from the dead in the Old Testament, it doesn't necessarily mean that those hints were seen. After all, there were also hints that the Messiah would suffer and die and rise again. But the people didn't see that until after Jesus came and did those things. So there are teachings in the Old Testament which were not very thoroughly processed by the Jews. And I would say there's no unambiguous reference to the resurrection in the Old Testament. The most likely reference to the resurrection in the prophets would be in Daniel chapter 12, where it talks about those who sleep in the dust shall arise. But it only says many of those who sleep in the dust shall arise. And while this may be talking about the resurrection at the last day, it may have another meaning, which we can't explore right now. The main thing I would point out is that there are apparently hints about the resurrection of the dead in the Old Testament. But the Jews didn't have a very clear or developed theology of the afterlife. The resurrection became much more part of the Jewish thinking during the intertestamental period, that is, after the Old Testament was completed, and when the rabbis were sorting things out, and they're in some respects borrowing from Egypt and from Greece and from Persia some of the notions of the afterlife that got worked into the rabbinic teachings. Many of those we probably couldn't agree with because they came from pagan sources. But nonetheless, Jesus certainly confirmed, and the apostles confirmed, that there will be a resurrection of the dead. But not all the Jews saw it there. The Sadducees, for example, were a major scholarly group of Jews who didn't believe that there was a resurrection in the Old Testament taught. And the Pharisees did believe it in the time of Jesus. So obviously it was something that was unclear enough that major theological schools would have a total disagreement about the presence of a resurrection, which means that the average Jew probably didn't have any real assurance of life after death or even of the resurrection. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't believe in it. Lots of people who aren't even Christians believe there's probably something after this. Lots of people believe in reincarnation, probably. Some people believe in heaven and hell without really believing the gospel. Because people intuitively think there must be something after this because this life is so unjust. So many people die unrewarded for their righteous lives, and other people die without having suffered for the wickedness in their life. There's no real justice in the end if this life is all there is and death is the end of it. And therefore, almost all religions have an idea of a life after death. As I said, Hinduism, Buddhism believe in a reincarnation that will help address or redress that problem. Judaism, Christianity, and I think Islam, if I'm not mistaken, believe there will be a resurrection at the end and a judgment to redress that. So religions do believe that this life is not all there is. And I think that proves that even those religions that have no revelation from God, but have their man-made religions, they still believe there's a life after death, which means the Jews, who had no direct or clear revelation about it, probably had views about the afterlife too, but they did not appear in the Old Testament very clearly because the Old Testament was not written by the average Jew about his own opinions. The Old Testament was written by prophets who were getting inspiration, and God didn't inspire them with any knowledge about that, not anything that was unambiguous. Now, Carol mentions Psalm 23, where David said, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." And many people feel like this is a reference to going to heaven when you die. And maybe David thought of it that way. But more likely, when he talked about the house of the Lord, he's probably thinking about the tabernacle. Because in David's day, the tabernacle was referred to as the house of the Lord, or God's house. And David did speak elsewhere about his desire to dwell in the tabernacle, and how one day in the courts of the tabernacle was better than 1,000 days elsewhere. And how he had one thing that he desired of the Lord, that's might dwell in the tabernacle and meditate on the beauty of the Lord there. So David found great enjoyment going to the house of God, the tabernacle. Remember, he wrote, or at least some Jew wrote, "I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord." He meant the tabernacle or the temple, not heaven. The house of the Lord in the Old Testament was never a reference to heaven. It was a reference to the tabernacle or the temple. Even Jesus used the term that way when he said, "Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise." He was talking about the temple. So when David said, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever," I think he's saying, "I will have uninterrupted access to God in his tabernacle," and not necessarily a reference to the afterlife. Now, if somebody has chosen for that verse to be their favorite text about the afterlife in the Old Testament, I don't want to disabuse you of that or steal that from you. So, I mean, certainly a person can believe, if they prefer, that David is talking about the afterlife, but that's not altogether clear because David often spoke about the house of the Lord. And in most cases, certainly, I would say in all cases, he seemed to mean the tabernacle and was not talking about heaven. So when we read, "I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever," I often think you know, well, I'm going to go to heaven and I'm going to live there forever and so forth. I mean, that's not necessarily what David was thinking. It seems like the clear teaching about the resurrection was reserved for New Testament writings. But that doesn't mean people in the Old Testament had no opinions about it. I'm sure that most people who've ever lived, Jew or Gentile, have had some opinion about the afterlife, but they didn't necessarily have an authoritative word from God about it in the Old Testament. All right, let's talk to Jonathan from Monroe, Oregon. Jonathan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good afternoon.
Same
here.
Hey,
I had a couple questions. Just real quick, on my first question, we had a friend of ours, my wife and I, that died last week, and I was just kind of curious. You probably get this question a lot. And she was a Christian. She was a very good sister in the Lord. And I'm just kind of wondering, when you die, I know there's a place in Romans where it says, like, you're with the Lord. When you die, I'm just kind of curious, when you die and you're faithful, where you end up? Are you in paradise, or are you that question? And then my other question was in Judges 19, 24, you know, the story of the daughter or the concubine that was given to the man, and they divided her body, not the man, but
the husband.
You know the story, I think. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of wondering why that man did that and gave that concubine, or that, I think it was his daughter.
Well, I should put my wife on to answer that for you, because we were just reading about that this morning in our morning devotions. So that's very timely. Actually, my wife is shaking her head. She doesn't want to answer it for you, so I guess I'll have to do it.
Okay. But it was my wife who was asking me about it, so funny.
It is disturbing. It is disturbing. Well, let's take your first question first. Where do Christians go when they die? Well, that kind of piggybacks on the previous question that I was dealing with. But there are two opinions. One is that Christians, when they die, and non-Christians too, when they die, are unconscious, that they're nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then when Jesus comes back, he raises the dead, and they were in a state of soul slumber, soul sleep, from which they awaken. And therefore, Christians, on this view, Christians who have died are dead. They're nowhere. They don't know anything right now. They're simply in a non-existent state. But when Jesus comes back, they'll awaken along with the rest of us and be raised immortal and live forever with Christ. That's the soul sleep doctrine, or something very much like it. A much more common view among Christians, and the one that I personally hold, is that when we die, our bodies, which are merely the vehicle for our soul, who we are, it goes into the ground and it decays. But the person that we are moves out. That when you actually die, you move out of your body and you go elsewhere. James said that the body without a spirit is dead. So when the spirit leaves the body, that's death. And Paul did say that while we are in this body, or at home in the body, we're absent from the Lord. This is in 2 Corinthians 5:6. But in verse 8, he says, we are confident, yes, well pleased rather, to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. So Paul talks about us being able to be in the body or out of the body, absent from the body or present in it. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 12, he talked about a man who he knew who was caught up into the third heaven but wasn't dead. But Paul says he didn't know if he went up in the body or out of the body. In other words, Paul believed, Paul didn't have a certainty about whether this was an out-of-body experience, but he certainly believed in the possibility of it, or else he would say it wasn't out of the body. He said, I don't know if it was in the body or out of the body. So he obviously believed in a person's conscious self being able to be out of their body or in it. And that's what he says. We're at home in our body in this life, but when we're absent from our body, then we're present with the Lord. And, of course, Paul said something very much like that in Philippians when he was talking about his own preference to live or to die, because he was in prison. It was pretty a hard life. He says, in Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. But if I remain on in the flesh, he means in my body, this will mean fruit from my labor. Yet what I shall choose I cannot tell, for I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the body or in the flesh is more needful for you. So he says, you know, I wish I could just depart and be with Christ from my body, but I'll probably, he says that's one possibility, but the other possibility is that I'll stay in my body so I can get more work done. I think that's probably what God's going to have me do. So Paul talked about himself as someone who could be in his body or out of his body, and that when we die, we are out of our body, but present with the Lord. So that is my understanding, and that's the, I think, the majority view of the church as well. And it's not every day that I hold the majority view of the church on something.
Right. So yeah, she's not there anymore. She's up.
Right.
She's with the Lord. Yeah.
And your other question was about the story in Judges chapter 19 where a man was traveling with his concubine, and she was attacked and gang raped and actually to death, and she died. And he, in order to get some kind of retributive justice against the city that did this, he cut her body, her dead body, into pieces and sent the pieces off to the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, he didn't explain this, but they apparently knew what to do. We see another situation very much like it in 1 Samuel 11 and verse 7. This time it's not a human that's cut up, but the bodies of oxen are cut up, and the parts of the oxen's body are sent out to all the different tribes of Israel with an announcement that whoever doesn't show up to fight in war, his oxen will be cut up like this. In other words, the cutting up of the ox into pieces and sending the parts out was a way of saying, you know, this is what's going to happen to your ox if you don't show up to fight in this war that I'm calling you to. That is apparently the implied meaning of this man cutting up the dead body of his concubine and sending it out. Pretty grotesque, to be sure. I mean, it's an ugly, ugly picture, and the Bible doesn't pretend otherwise. But it was apparently a summons to the 12 tribes to gather for war. And
was
maybe
God happy with that? Like, was God okay with that?
With them fighting in that war?
No, I mean, with the cutting up, like, wouldn't God be unhappy with that kind of a thing?
Well, it's weird. It's ghastly, but I don't really know if it's immoral. I mean, if a dead body is cut up or burned or buried or whatever, I mean, I don't know if there's anything moral that attaches to it or immoral that attaches to it, but it's certainly would be grotesque and ghastly. I don't know that. I don't know that the man was doing something immoral. I mean, if my body was cut up when I was dead, well, I wouldn't care. You know, what's the difference between that?
Right.
What's the difference between that and being eaten by worms? You know, I mean, it's, you know, when our bodies are dead, they're dead. It is a weird custom, obviously, of the ancient Near East. We see King Saul doing that with the oxen. We see this man doing it with his wife. I'm not saying it's a good thing. I'm just saying it's a cultural thing. It's something that was understood to mean a summons. What it was saying is, this injustice has been done. You know, here you have received this forearm with a hand in the mail. You know, I mean, it sounds like something gangsters send to people before they come and attack their families. But basically, it apparently came with the implied notification. This is what will happen to you if you don't respond, because there's a need to redress an injustice, the murder of this woman. He actually did it in order to redress her murder. You know, she was murdered by this town, and he's gathering the armies to come and fight against this town for doing this kind of thing. So strange as it is to us, and yet, you know, when people like us read the Bible, we sometimes think that's crazy behavior. And a lot of times what we read in the Bible is kind of wicked behavior, certainly a lot of wicked behavior in the Bible. But all the cultural differences aren't necessarily crazy. They're just culturally different. I mean, there are cultures that different from ours on the planet right now. If you go into certain jungles and stuff like that and find tribal people, their customs would say, how in the world would people have such weird customs as these?
Well, what I thought was,
if you go to the ancient,
my wife told me, was that he actually gave her to those men? Like, why did he do it? Wasn't that her father?
No, that was her husband. Yeah, it was. Oh, it was very much. It was very much like what Lot offered to do. The story resembles the story of Lot in Sodom in several particulars. In both cases, guests had come to the home, and then the men of the city surrounded the home, wanting to rape the guests. And in both cases, they were offered someone instead. Now, in this case, the man offered his concubine. This is a pretty awful thing to do. I don't think that was a right thing to do, obviously. He may have been angry at her because earlier in the story she had cheated on him. She was his wife, and she says played the harlot. She cheated on him.
Yeah, that's right.
And left him. Yeah. And so, you know, they weren't really on real good terms, obviously. And if it was going to, I think his attitude was, if it's going to be me or you, it's going to be you. You know, if they're going to either rape me to death or rape you to death, it's going to be, you know, for me, for him, that was an easy call because he didn't love her very much, apparently. I don't know. But it's not, you know, this man is not set forth as an example for us any more than David is set forth as an example when he rapes or, you know, takes advantage of his neighbor's wife and has her husband killed. I mean, the Bible tells true stories about, you know, crazy and wicked things that people do. And it tells them because they are true, not because they are good things.
Oh. Well, it was good to hear your voice again, Steve. Hopefully you make it to Oregon one of these months.
I'm sure I will. God bless you, Jonathan.
God bless you. Bye.
Thanks for calling. All right. In just a few minutes, we're going to have to take a break, but let's try to take another call if we can. Earl from Roseville, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hello, Steve.
Hi.
Yeah, I don't think a couple of minutes is going to be enough time for some of the questions I wanted to ask you. So,
well, we can hold you through the break, perhaps. But
okay,
let's get started.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that.
Go ahead. We can start.
Okay. Yeah, I've been listening to your program since last December, and every once in a while the subject of Calvinism will come up, but the comments I've heard seem to be negative about it, so I wanted to ask you some questions about Calvin and his doctrine. First of all, who was Calvin, and was he part of the Reformation, and was he a contemporary of Martin Luther? Is Calvinism a theology about predetermination, and do you see any good points about it?
Well, Calvin was a second-generation reformer. Luther was first generation.
Oh, okay.
Their lives overlapped each other, I believe, but they were in different countries. Luther was in Germany, and Calvin was a Frenchman, but he lived in Switzerland. And he was, like I say, in the next generation of reformers. Calvin, like Luther, had been a Roman Catholic and converted to the Protestant beliefs. Calvin had studied for the priesthood in the Catholic Church, but I think he had not completed his studies, but instead became a lawyer, if I recall correctly. But then he became a religious leader, especially as the result of writing his book, The Institutes of the Christian Religion, which is still considered to be one of the major theological works of history. And what he did is he revived the doctrines of Augustine. Augustine lived in the 4th century and into the 5th century and had originated certain doctrines that had never been taught in the church before, certain doctrines about God's meticulous providence and his predestining of those who would be saved, and some of these issues that are associated with Calvinism. They originated with St. Augustine. And Calvin simply took most of what Augustine had said on these subjects and revitalized it, gave it a new life by writing it into his theology. And he became a very important teacher in Geneva, Switzerland, which is, you know, where he became famous. And his theology was spread to especially Scotland and throughout Switzerland and quite a few other countries, eventually, of course, all over the world. Now, as far as the particulars of his theology, we can talk about that after we come back from the break. But as far as who he was, yeah, he was a second-generation reformer who had trained as a Catholic priest but didn't ever become a priest. And then he became a sort of a political and religious leader in Geneva, Switzerland, and that's where his influence spread from. And he is considered to be the main theologian of the Reformation, although Luther is considered to be kind of the founder of the Reformation. Calvin is the first to have written an extensive systematic theology of the Reformation. So he's considered to be the primary theologian of the Reformation. Listen, we can talk more about him after you come. I'm going to put you on hold, and we're going to come back after the break. If you just hold through the break, I'm going to have to sign off for a few of our stations. All right, we'll be right back with you, brother. Some of our stations leave us at this point. We do go on for another half hour, and most of our stations carry the whole hour. If you are leaving right now, we want you to know that you can hear the whole program from our website, thenarrowpath.com, or you can get the app for your phone, thenarrowpath.com, and you can hear the whole program from your phone every day. You won't have to miss half hour every day. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us out, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or, of course, you can donate from the website if you wish. That's thenarrowpath.com. For those of you remaining with us, please hang on for 30 seconds. We'll be right back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are continuing on our program. For some of our stations that pick us up at this point, we want all of our listeners there to know the program is an hour long, though there's only a half hour remaining. And you can hear the whole program from our website, thenarrowpath.com, every day if you wish to. We're taking your calls, as we usually do. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Just before our break, we were talking to Earl, who's calling from Roseville, California. We were talking about John Calvin, and we ran out of time, so we'll pick it up again. Earl, what more did you want to bring up?
Okay. Do you see any good points about this theology? I mean, I believe he wrote a lot, and from some small parts that I read about it, the man seemed to be pretty intellectual and seemed to be well-learned. So do you see anything good, some really, informative information about his theology that seems to be pretty much on par with biblical theology?
Well, yeah, probably about 90% of his theology would be. Yeah, I mean, like any Christian theologian, I would expect to agree with him on about 90% or more. Whenever I read any theologian, I also expect there'll probably be something or another there that I won't fully agree with him about. I don't expect someone to agree with me completely, and I don't expect that somebody has to in order for me to, you know, learn something of value from them. Now, as far as Calvin goes, he's strictly got Reformation theology, very similar to Luther's. I don't agree with as much of it as many Christians do, but see, most of his theology is not what you'd call Calvinism. Most of his theology would be the same as yours and mine about almost everything, that Jesus is the Son of God, Jesus is the Lord, he did miracles, he died on the cross for our sins, he rose from the dead, he's reigning at the right hand of God today. It's important to live a holy life. I mean, God created the world. I mean, these kinds of things that virtually all Christians believe anyway, he believed those things too. So his book, Institutes of the Christian Religion, only a few chapters deal with what we could call Calvinism. Now, what's called Calvinism is that part of his teaching that is not agreed upon by most Christians. Probably, like I said, if you read through his whole theology, about 90% of what he teaches, almost every Christian would be able to say, amen, I agree with that. But there are some distinctives of his, and those are the distinctives that are called Calvinism. Not everything Calvin believed is Calvinism, because there are non-Calvinists who believe most of what he wrote too. What we call Calvinism are the distinctives that he taught that are contrary to what most Christians have believed historically. And that is certain views that he got from St. Augustine. Now, Augustine, writing in the 4th century, introduced certain doctrines about salvation which had never been taught by Orthodox Christian teachers previously. In the first 3 centuries of the church, these doctrines were familiar to the church fathers, but they rejected them as heresy. The doctrines were doctrines that were associated with Manichaeanism. Manichaeanism was a heresy that was denounced by all the church fathers, including Augustine. But Augustine had been a Manichaean before he was a Christian. And when he first became a Christian, he wrote books against Manichaeanism. But when he got older, he changed his theology on some things, and especially when he was engaged in a controversy with a man named Pelagius. And you know, when people are in controversy with people that they consider to be heretics, they tend to gravitate kind of to the far edges of distance from their opponent. And in this context of controversy, Augustine kind of moved back into some views which he would not have said were Manichaean, but anyone who's not a Calvinist can look on and say, well, those are Manichaean views he's going back to. So virtually everything that's distinctive of Calvinism came from Augustine. And Augustine, I won't say he got it from Manichaeanism, but it's interesting that he was a Manichaean for some time, and then he introduced similar ideas in his theology late in life. But I will say that those distinctives of Calvinism were rejected as heretical by the church fathers up until the 4th century. So, and by the way, even after Augustine, even today, many people reject them as heretical. Now, the views that he introduced, that Augustine introduced, and that are considered to be Calvinism today, have to do with the nature of God's governing the universe. And in other words, how does he exercise his sovereignty? All Christians believe that God is sovereign, which means he has the right to do whatever he wants to. He has all authority. He's the creator. He made it. He's the potter. We're the clay. God can do whatever he wants with his clay. And therefore, that's what sovereignty means. But Calvinists take it further. And they say not only is God entitled to do whatever he wants to, but he actually governs everything down to the meticulous details. He micromanages the universe. And there's not one thing that happens that he doesn't make happen. And there's not one thing that he makes happen that he didn't predestine to happen. And so Augustine and Calvin afterwards began to develop an idea of predestination that involves God predetermining everything that would ever happen. Now, most of us wouldn't have serious problems with most of this, except that includes him predestining who's going to be a believer and who's not going to be a believer. That is, before the world began, according to Augustine and Calvin, God determined certain individuals would become believers, and all the other individuals would be unbelievers, which means God determined who would be saved and who would not be saved, and he did so before anyone had a choice in the matter at all. That this was something God determined about you or me before the world was created. That means that you and I were born with a certain destiny already determined and inevitable. And though we live in a world where we seem to be making free choices, these free choices are somewhat an illusion, because even the free choices we're making are not that free. They were predestined by God. We're just living out a script. We're just dancing a choreographed dance that was written out before we were here. We have the illusion of making free choices, but in fact, everything we decide is what God, in fact, foreordained. Calvin taught, as Augustine did, that God foreordained, inevitably, that Adam and Eve would sin. And every other sin, every person who sins, God foreordained it before the foundation of the world. And everyone who repents, God foreordained that too, and it was inevitably going to happen. So this is an application of the word sovereignty, which goes far beyond the normal meaning of the word sovereignty, and certainly far beyond anything the Bible says about God's sovereignty. But it became the reigning paradigm because one reason Calvinists love it is because they say it gives God all the glory for our salvation. They say if we don't accept this idea, then we are likely to take credit for our own righteous choice of becoming a believer. But if we accept the Calvinist idea, we can't take any credit for our choices because God foreordained and determined and made these choices take place so that God gets all the credit even for our good choices. But this is kind of a two-edged sword, because if God gets all the credit for our good choices in the system, he also gets all the blame or bears all the responsibility for the bad choices people make, because he preordained those too. Now, Calvinists will say God is not the author of sin, but the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is the premier statement of Calvinist theology, it says that God preordained that men would sin. And Calvin believed that too. And Augustine believed that too. And that is something, it's not just the same thing saying God knew. See, almost all Christians believe God knew that man would sin, that God knew who would be saved. There are some who don't believe that. They're called openness theologians. But most Christians do believe that God knew everything before it happened. That's very different from him preordaining it, because preordaining it means he set it up as inevitable. See, it's one thing for me to say, I know what's going to happen in this movie I'm watching because I saw the movie before and I know what's going to happen. That's one thing. But to say I'm making it happen or that I've determined that it will happen is a totally different issue. I didn't determine it. The guy who wrote the script determined it. The director determined it. The actors did it, not me. But I know what they're going to do because I saw the movie earlier and I'm going to watch it again here. So I can know what's going to happen without in any sense being the one causing it to happen. And almost all Christians throughout history have believed that God does know what's going to happen. But only Augustine introduced the idea that God preordained and he wrote the script and he's the one who's determined all that will happen. And that's what Calvinism teaches, and it has ramifications that many Christians can't stomach. The most considerable objection is that this is not taught in Scripture, but they think it is.
Okay, yeah, I can understand Christians disagreeing with that part of Calvin's doctrine that you called Calvinism. So anyways, yeah. I found all that pretty interesting, and I thank you for your answer, and I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Earl, for your call. Glad you joined us today. Okay, our next caller is AJ from Sacramento. Thanks for waiting, AJ. You've been waiting for about a half hour. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Steve.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. One question is a person who professes to be a prophet, he prayed and prophesied about a young boy who is a non-believer and he doesn't know Christ, because the Bible says prophecy is for believers, not for non-believers. And second question is, if he prophesies, then all the prophecies has to come true, like 100%, not just some of them he guess or just watching the news and prophesied. But if he's a prophet, then all his prophecies has to come true. So that's my two questions.
Well, you told me some things, but I didn't hear a question. But I think I can deduce your question. In fact, maybe two questions. One is,
yes,
should a person prophesy over a non-believer? That's one of them,
yes,
right? And the other is, if a person is a prophet, must all of his prophecies come true?
Yes.
Okay. As far as prophesying over an unbeliever, you are right. Paul said that prophecy is a gift for the believers and for the edification of the church. But I would not suggest that there's no occasion where God might give a prophecy to an unbeliever. You mentioned a young boy. Are his parents Christians?
No. And okay. He doesn't even know about Christ, who Christ
yeah.
is.
Well, I mean, God knows. God knows what's going to happen to this kid, and I wouldn't say that God couldn't prophesy over him. In the Old Testament, sometimes prophetic words were given to the kings of Israel who were wicked men and who were not believers. Very strong words were given to them, like Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 7 gives a prophecy to King Ahaz, who's a wicked king, and tells things about him and about the future. So even though Paul is saying that prophecy is a gift primarily for the edification of the church, that doesn't mean that God's hands are tied and that he can't, if he wants to, give a prophecy to somebody who isn't a believer. I just, you know, I wouldn't rule that out, though I think you're correct in saying that the principal purpose for prophecy is for the benefit of believers, not unbelievers. Now, the other thing you asked, does a prophecies always have to come true? I would say what it says in Deuteronomy 18 is if a person speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing he says does not come true, that's a word that was not spoken from the Lord. Now, he doesn't say whether somebody who gives a true prophecy on one occasion might give a false prophecy on another occasion, and the one that was true was from the Lord, and the one that was not true, that didn't come true, was not from the Lord. I mean, that is to say, a prophet is a human being. Nathan the prophet, was talking to David, and David said that he wanted to build a temple for God. And Nathan said, hey, do everything that's in your heart. The Lord is with you. Now, technically, Nathan didn't speak in the name of the Lord. He didn't say, thus saith the Lord, do it. We might suggest Nathan was just giving his own opinion. But as Nathan left, God spoke to Nathan and said, no, you go back and tell him that's not what I want done. And so he had to go back and correct himself. So Nathan, the prophet, was actually able to speak not correctly, and God had to correct him, and he had to go back and tell him, okay, this is really what the Lord said. Now, the first time, Nathan didn't really say, thus saith the Lord, though he seemed to be thinking he was giving the mind of the Lord. He said, the Lord is with you. The Lord is with you in this. But Nathan was wrong. And therefore, a man who is a prophet conceivably might, in his own personal life, be mistaken in what he thinks the Lord wants to say. And if he does say something and it doesn't come true, that was not what the Lord had to say through him. But it doesn't mean that the same man would never necessarily ever give a prophecy that's correct. After all, even Caiaphas, who was an unbeliever, accidentally gave a genuine prophecy in John chapter 11. And Balaam, who was an unbeliever, also gave true prophecies almost against his will on occasion. And even Saul, the King Saul, when he was persecuting David, fell among prophets, and he began to prophesy too. But he didn't always prophesy, and certainly most of what he did and said in his life was wicked. So, in other words, God can speak genuinely one time or a few times through somebody who's not really a reliable prophet. And that same person may pretend to be a reliable prophet. You know, the kings of Israel had prophets who were professionals, and like the Ahab's prophets in 1 Kings chapter 22, they were all telling him that the Lord is telling him to go and prosper in battle in Ramoth-Gilead. But in fact, a true prophet of the Lord came and says, no, you're going to die there. So we know there were people out there pretending to be real prophets, and the Bible says, beware of false prophets. Jesus said, beware of false prophets. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, do not despise prophesying, but he said, test all things and hold fast to that which is good. So Paul said in 1 Corinthians 14, let the prophet speak two or three and let the others judge. Now, why should they judge? The idea seems to be that some of the prophecies that might be spoken are not genuine. So a prophecy that doesn't come true is certainly not a true prophecy from God. But it's not clear that everyone that gives a false prophecy on some occasion would never give a genuine prophecy, since people like Caiaphas could give genuine prophecies on rare occasions. So I would say every prophecy has to be judged individually. But if a person gives a false prophecy, then of course it raises serious doubts about whether he knows how to hear the Lord or not. if a man gives true prophecies, let's say he gives 10 prophecies and 9 of them are true and one of them he misses it, we'd have to say, well, 9 of those were prophecies from the Lord. One was not. He was just giving his own opinion. And that would raise questions about the reliability of his prophecies. If he gave 10 prophecies and 7 of them were true and 3 were false, it really raises questions. I mean, I've known some people who gave many prophecies, and the only ones you could test turned out to be false, but they still had a reputation of being prophets. So I'm very skeptical, to tell you the truth. I'm very skeptical when people prophesy. At the same time, I believe there are true prophecies, but I think they have to be judged individually. The prophecies have to be judged individually, because even a man who has been used by God to give some true prophecies might be unreliable on other occasions.
Okay. Yeah, so like if he prophesies like 5% are true and 95% is false, which will not happen. Like yeah. He prophesied that our pastor will go England and he said that he saw him sitting in Rolls Royce and he will be meeting the Queen, and which I think is impossible to happen. So,
well, you know, when I've heard people prophesy, and I have to say I don't hang out with people like that very much, but I've certainly been in circles where there were people prophesying on many, many occasions. I would say the majority of those who've prophesied and actually made predictions about something, if there was anything unlikely about those predictions to come true, they usually didn't come true. I mean, it used to be fairly common to find a person would prophesy over a pregnant woman, say, oh, you're going to have a boy. Well, sometimes she did, sometimes she didn't, about 50-50%, you know, I mean, If you're prophesying something that has such a low risk of being correct, then even when it turns out true, it gives you no particular credentials. You know, if I prophesied your wife who's pregnant is going to have a boy. Well, if it's a boy, that doesn't mean I knew anything. It means I guessed it was a 50-50 chance and I guessed right. But when they are things that are much more unpredictable, it's very rare, in my experience, to hear someone prophesy something that's very unpredictable and then have it also come true. But you need to be careful when people call themselves prophets because, frankly, I've never seen in my lifetime a person whose prophecies always come true. And that raises serious doubts about the prophecies they give that cannot be tested.
Okay, thank you. You answered my question.
Okay, AJ, thanks for your call. Carolyn from Seattle, Washington is next. Carolyn, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I know that there is no set age of accountability in the Bible, at least I don't think there is.
Right.
But I have a friend that when her son, who was 19, died, I directed her to Numbers 14:29, where it said that from 20 years old and upward that those would die. And so, saying that this was to give you hope, I was told I was wrong to do that. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't say that you're wrong to point that out because there may be some validity in that. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 1, when it is speaking to the Israelites who were 20 years old and younger, Moses specifically mentions that they had not known any good or evil, that they were so young that they did not know good and evil, even though they were, some of them were nearly 20 years old. There is not, as you said, there is not an actual age of accountability that is identified for us. The Bible does indicate that God does take into consideration a child's ignorance and youth, and a person is not accountable for what they don't know or what they cannot know. I mean, we might be accountable for things we don't know because we should have known, because we had opportunity to know, but we didn't want to know. Peter talks in 2 Peter 3 about those who are willingly ignorant about God's judgment. Well, if they're willingly ignorant, they're not really ignorant in a sense that would absolve them of responsibility because they're choosing to be ignorant. But if a person really has no opportunity to know something, and that is true of a baby or a little child, then the Bible does indicate they're not accountable. I mean, there is a there is a reference in Isaiah 7, I think it's verse 15 or so, where it talks about a child being born. It says, before he knows to refuse the evil and to choose the good, the land that you dread will be abandoned by her kings. there's a reference there to a child being born and having a time of his life before he knows to choose the good and to refuse the evil, which is it's obvious. I mean, a baby doesn't know to do that. But
right.
at what point in a person's life are they responsible? Now, the Jews apparently thought of age 13, because that's when they bar mitzvah their boys at age 13. And at age 13, when in bar mitzvah, a Jewish boy is considered to become responsible to keep the law of God for himself. Before that, he was kind of under the covering of his parents' religious faithfulness, and now he's expected to do it himself, which is something of an age of accountability. But we can't prove from Scripture that that's a correct way of looking at things, because although it is the Jewish custom of bar mitzvah at age 13, we don't have anything in the Bible that reveals that that is the age when a child reaches that. Bar mitzvah is not mentioned in the Bible. So there are different opinions. Some people would say a child, I've actually thought perhaps a child can be seen to be knowing something about right and wrong when they become, when they want to wear clothes in front of people. A little baby doesn't care if they're dressed or undressed in public. I mean, they run around, even 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds run around naked. They're not self-conscious. But usually around age 5 or 6, even if you don't teach them to, kids want to get dressed behind closed doors. They don't want people watching them go to the bathroom. They don't want to run around naked in front of people. They get a little embarrassed. And I think of how Adam and Eve, when they receive the knowledge of good and evil after eating the forbidden fruit, suddenly their nakedness, which had been a reality all along, became an issue to them. Then they wanted to hide themselves. It's like once they had this knowledge, this moral knowledge, they then didn't want to be seen naked. But when they were innocent, they didn't mind. They were naked and not ashamed, the Bible says. And I think sometimes maybe when we see a child getting to a place where they don't want to be seen naked anymore, maybe they've kind of crossed some threshold there. I don't know. The Bible doesn't give us solid answers, but you're right. There is that hint that the people of Israel who are under 20 years old are treated as though they were not accountable. But that might only be because they didn't have any say-so. I mean, they weren't accountable for their father's sins because as people that young, they weren't in the voting population. You know, they were young. I think that God holds people accountable based on how much they understand, because some people are much more mature at age 13 than others. And some people at age 33, I mean, they're mentally challenged and they don't have quite the same grasp of some issues that a 12-year-old might have. So God has to judge case by case. But certainly infants, I believe, have not reached a point of accountability. And God himself has to keep tabs on each person's development so that he knows when they know and when they know to a degree that they can be held accountable. So I don't think you did the wrong thing, but I don't know that we have any solid scriptural basis for arguing the point you were making, except you're just trying to hold out some hope, and I don't really see how that would hurt.
Thank you.
All right, I appreciate your call. God bless you. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we do this Monday through Friday for an hour every weekday afternoon. We do pay for the time on the radio stations, and it costs lots of money. We're listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the bills so we can stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website, which is thenarrowpath.com, but there's lots of resources, hundreds of resources, every one of them free to you at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.